Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. Here's where we're headed this morning. We'll begin by talking about bears, then speak to a Vermonter about his first novel. At 10, we check in with national correspondent Bob Ney. Next, Kathy Resmer of 7 Days shares the story of a Vermont farmer who became the first person in the country to manufacture and sell globes. And we'll finish by hearing how you can get a job at the same time you're catching a foul ball souvenir. But first, the bears. Social media and the news are rife with reports of bear encounters in Vermont, and most of us would rather avoid that. So let's learn how to, and also what to do if we are faced with a bear conflict. Joining me now is wildlife biologist and Black Bear Project leader for Vermont Fish and Wildlife, Jacqueline Camo. Jacqueline, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask Jacqueline a black bear question, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Now, Jacqueline, we only have black bears in Vermont, so how big, how aggressive is this species of bear?
Sure. So our black bears, adult black bears, typically range in size from like 120 pounds to maybe just under 200 pounds for females, and then adult males will be more in that 200 to 300 pound range. They can get bigger, but those are kind of the typical sizes that they reach here in Vermont.
And are they generally aggressive? How strong are they?
No, they're, you know, we're lucky. Black bears are extremely tolerant bears to be around people. They tend to be very passive and try to avoid encountering us, but they're also smart. They're able to learn, and they will, over time, if they realize that we're not a threat to them, they will become bolder and willing to spend more time close to us. But even in those situations, they really don't want to have much to do with us. They're not aggressive like folks hear about with grizzly bears.
Right.
They, for the most part, want to avoid confrontations with us.
All right. We like that.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about their habits and their habitat?
Sure. So bears, you know, like most wildlife, are very food-oriented. But, of course, bears are a little bit more food-oriented because – you know, they have a much shorter window to put on weight. Because they den during the winter, you know, they have to get in all the calories they need for the year just during the spring, summer, and fall. So they're really, really focused on looking for high-calorie foods. Their natural foods are primarily made up of vegetation and plant materials. So they're eating grasses, leaves. But the bulk of their food is coming from berries and nuts that our plants produce. And then they're also looking for things like insects and meat opportunistically when they can find it. And so I think the thing that's important for folks to know is, you know, they're what we consider an opportunistic omnivore. So their diets are very diverse, but they're also really flexible. And so they're kind of always willing to explore and try new foods.
And then tell us about their habitat.
Sure. So, again, their habitat is keyed into where they can find those foods. Mm. And the big kind of features they're looking for are various wetland habitats, young forest habitats. And those are areas that support a lot of those berries that they like and the vegetation that they need. And then they're also looking for mature forest habitats to find the nuts, like beech nuts and acorns. And then those, you know, more mature forests where there's lots of down rotting logs and standing dead trees, those support a lot of the insects that they rely on. So they're really looking for a lot of habitat diversity. And that's part of the reason, too, that they need a lot of space. And what we look for is like a connected landscape, because they need to be able to safely move around Vermont to find those different habitats and foods that they need.
Jacqueline, I sadly must admit I must be part bear, because I seem to bulk up on rich foods in spring, summer, and fall, but I don't stop eating in the winter. But now, the bear population in Vermont, what is it right now?
So over the past decade, our population has really been fluctuating pretty consistently between approximately 4,500 bears to 6,500 bears. Right now, our most recent estimate for 2021, because we're always kind of 1 year behind the way we do our estimates, shows us near the upper limit of that range. So right now, we think we're in that like 6,000-ish bears within the state range. But of course, that's, you know, distributed across the entire state. So there's some parts of the states where we might have more and other parts where we have less.
And where does Fish and Wildlife like to see that number?
Yeah, our management goal is to have it a little bit lower than that. Right now, our management goal is kind of shooting for like 35 to 5,500 bears. So we're a little bit above the target. But, you know, we're still like where we typically see our bear population or where it has been for the past decade.
And Jacqueline, I know Fish and Wildlife doesn't pluck that number out of the air, that, you know, goal of 3,500 to 5,500, that carrying capacity. How is that determined?
Yeah, so it's a mix of what we consider like biological carrying capacity. So how much space and habitat we have for bears here in Vermont. And then it's also paired with what we call social carrying capacity. So what is the tolerance of, you know, the Vermont public for seeing and encountering bears in our state. And those kind of mixed together are where we've kind of set that target range. You know, and we just did a new kind of what we call big game management plan, which covers the years of 2020 up to 2030. And so in preparation for that, we did a lot of public surveys to see where Vermonters were at in terms of their tolerance for bears. And the majority of Vermonters said that they were comfortable and happy with where our bear population was at. So like I said, we've kind of been fluctuating in this 45 to 6,500 bear range. And for the most part, Vermonters are comfortable with that. It's starting to feel like, though, based on the reports of conflicts we get, that when we do creep up into that 6,000 bear range, that seems to maybe be where we start to see a real pressure point in terms of increased interactions between people and bears.
Yeah, let's talk about those conflicts. How many bear conflicts do we tend to see in a typical year in Vermont?
Yeah, so every year is a little different. We tend to see fluctuations where 1 year we'll get a lot of reports and then the next year things will quiet down a bit and it kind of fluctuates back and forth. So we'll kind of look at pooled averages to get a sense of what is typical to experience here in Vermont. And we have been seeing an increase though. You know, the past 6 years we've been averaging a little over 700 reports a year, whereas the previous 6 years, so kind of the first half of the decade, we were only experiencing around a little over 300 reports a year. So, yeah, things have been on the rise for sure. And part of that might be, you know, reflected in this kind of slow increase we've been seeing in the bear population the last couple years. We have kind of over the past few years climbed from down at the lower end of that population range, like 4,500-ish bears. And like I said, we're now at that upper range. So that might explain part of the reason we're seeing the increase. But we really feel like the other big thing that's going on right now is that our bears are learning that our backyards, our communities are a reliable place to find easy, high-calorie foods. And so they're shifting their behavior to instead of just be foraging out in those wetlands and young forest habitats and mature forests, they're more regularly putting our backyards in their route to find food. And that's what is concerning to us and really why we're trying to get more Vermonters to understand this is a problem and we need everyone to kind of step up and do their part to help keep our bears wild.
How many have we seen these bear conflicts? How many have we seen so far this year?
Yeah, so we don't have all the data tallied because it's ongoing.
Yeah.
But we have two ways where people can reach out to us primarily. One is by contacting their game warden directly. I don't have that data compiled at this point. But the other way that folks can reach out to us is we have an online public reporting form. And at this point, just this morning, we have over 780 reports that we've received through that public online reporting form. And I would expect, you know, the wardens have handled well over 100 reports themselves. So, you know, we're well over 100 reported incidents at this point. Mm. And when we started putting out these press releases, compiling the data, just like the end of last week, we were down at like 700 reports. So it's growing quickly.
Yeah. Jacqueline, before the break, we talked about the number so far this year, which seems like a pretty substantial increase. Any explanation why we have seen this number rising like this?
Yeah, we really feel like, you know, it's a mix of a variety of factors. You know, natural food availability can drive these behaviors, but I really think the crux of it is that, like I said before, our bears have started to learn that there's a lot of high-calorie foods in our backyards and in our communities, and they're learning to make our backyards a regular stopping point to find food. And every time they're able to find garbage, bird seed, pet food, chicken feed in our backyards, that only reinforces them to keep coming back and to keep searching in those areas for foods. And so that's why we're putting out all this information right now, is to get Vermonters to realize that if we want relief from this problem, it's really up to each of us to do our part to make sure that when a bear visits our backyard, there's no food for them to find.
Yeah, great point. Let's go to Tom in Duxbury. Tom, go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Great conversation. Hey, can you speak, or your guest speak, to how old Vermont bears get and their relationship with the mothers and the cubs and when they break up and that? I saw a program recently on it, and I the answers I saw on that were a little different than I thought. I'm curious how that is, really.
Yeah, great question, Tom. So, Jacqueline, can you answer Tom's questions?
Sure. Black bears have been found to live into their 30s. That's not necessarily super common, but it is possible for them to live that long. We see bears in Vermont, you know, that can live well into their teens, even into their 20s. And again, the oldest bear ever recorded in Vermont was in its 30s. So it is possible. Cubs stay with their mother for about a year and a half. So during that time that they're all together, you know, that's a huge learning experience for those bear cubs. You know, their mom is not only keeping them alive, but she's also teaching them what is food, where is food, how do I get food during different seasons. Around a year and a half old, the bear cub will start to disperse from their mom's home range. And that's typically, we think, inspired by the female bear coming into heat and breeding again with males, and she'll drive those cubs off.
Mm-hmm.
Female bear cubs, typically, if they can, will set up a home range either adjacent to or even overlapping with their mother, which, again, when you think about conflicts, is important to remember. If, you know, you have a female bear showing up in your backyard with cubs, she's going to be coming back for years, and any of those female cubs may also be coming back for years. Male bear cubs will disperse really far from their mother typically. But again, all those learned experiences that they learned as a cub from their mom may stay with them for decades in the new area where they set up their home range.
Mm. Jacqueline, we've got a lot of callers who want to speak with you. But before we do, I really want to make sure we cover, what do we do? What do we do at our homes or at a campsite, wherever, to put up the "Hey, bears, stay away" sign to avoid these encounters?
Sure. So the low-hanging fruit that you can do is to make sure you're not putting out any obvious foods that would draw a bear in. And the big one is a bird feeder. We really can't recommend it enough that people should not be putting out bird feeders come spring, summer, and fall. And this includes, you know, any sort of, like, seed-based feeder because, again, bird seed is very similar to bears' wild foods, so it's not a stretch for them to try and feed from those. Even hummingbird feeders can attract bears. So your best option if you want to attract birds is to consider planting flowers and different shrubs and trees that provide the foods birds need, not putting out bird feeders. It really, you know, we just had a bear a few weeks ago try to break into somebody's house who had been putting out a bird feeder. They were taking the bird feeder in at night, but even that, that's not a deterrent. You just can't have the bird feeder out at all. It really can ratchet up a lot of conflicts with bears. The harder thing to deal with is our garbage, but the key things to think about with keeping a bear out of your garbage is odor control and secure storage. So making sure you're keeping your garbage in something like a locked garage, a sturdy shed, your basement, looking into investing in a bear-proof garbage can, or maybe even retrofitting your garbage can to make it bear-resistant. And we have tons of information about that on our Living with Black Bears webpage. And then if you keep backyard livestock, especially chickens, bees, even sheep, things like that, you really need to keep a really high-voltage electric fence around those animals and then make sure you're storing bear feed in, again, some sort of bear-proof container or some sort of building that will keep bears out.
Yep. All right, let's take another call. Lawrence joins us from Marshfield. Hi, Lawrence.
Good morning, both of you. About the last 10 years, we've had twice a bear come down, once eating our berries and once eating our apples. And immediately my partner Connie ran into the kitchen, grabbed a big metal bowl and a big spoon, and ran out and just started whacking it. And
whacking the bowl with the spoon, not the bear.
The bear ran both times. It was different bears. Both times they just ran. I mean, at first I think they stood up a little bit to see what was going on, but they don't like loud sounds and especially obnoxious sounds. And a metal bowl with a metal spoon just made it run. So.
Yeah, Lawrence, that's perfect for the next question. Jacqueline, if we do encounter a bear, what are the ways that would drive them off? What should we do?
Sure. That's, you know, Lawrence's example is perfect, and that's what we do recommend is do what you can to make that bear feel uncomfortable in your yard. Bang pots and pans, yell, holler, you know, if you have an air horn or any other really loud noise-making device, if you can set off a car alarm, something like that to really kind of shock the bear, scare the bear, that's great. Unfortunately, what we do see, though, is if the bears keep getting really high-calorie foods, they can become more tolerant to our loud noises. And so we are hearing reports from folks who are trying to yell at the bear. It's not necessarily just running away, but we still really encourage you to keep yelling, keep making noise, keep letting that bear know that you're there and you're going to keep kind of harassing it until it leaves. And that coupled with making sure the bear does not get into any food sources at your house, those two things working together should help to kind of reteach our bears that backyards are not a place for them to be looking for foods.
All right, great advice. Let's go over to New York, talk to Karen. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Hi, Rick, and hello. I've been listening not since the beginning, so I hope I'm not repeating anything.
It's all right.
We live in the Adirondacks, similar to, you know, a lot of Vermont geography.
Yep.
And, of course, there's black bears. So I was walking with our dogs, two dogs, and this is a few weeks ago, and we encountered a bear in the woods, The dogs were ahead, and they encountered the bear. It was probably a young male alone, and they barked, or one barked, and scared the bear up the tree. And then the dogs came when I called. So I think that worked out fine. I actually, was calling to them, making that loud noise. I didn't have any pots or pans with me. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, just, of course, I know it depends on the dog themselves.
Very quickly, Karen. We're almost out of time.
Okay. Are dogs and bears known enemies, would you say? Is a dog a deterrent?
Gotcha.
Bear coming?
Good question. Jacqueline, we got about 45 seconds for an answer.
Yes. Bears definitely do not like dogs. They are afraid of them. But we do warn folks, make sure your dog is under either really good voice control or on a leash, because some bears will stand their ground, depending on the bear, depending on the dog. So if you think your dog is the type to just kind of rush headlong into a dangerous situation, you probably want to be a little more careful and keep it under control if you have a bear coming around.
All right. Great question, Karen. Thanks for that. Jacqueline Camo is a wildlife biologist and Black Bear Project leader for Vermont Fish and Wildlife. There's still more to learn about the black bear population. You can go to vtfishandwildlife.com to learn more. Jacqueline, thank you so much for this helpful information.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we'll be back to talk with Peter Cobb about his new book. And coming up this morning at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. That's followed by the Midday News Service with Lee Cattell. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. On the cover of the new book, To Alice, Peter Cobb has a question. It reads, "Is caring too much a bad thing?" It's a subject that's explored throughout the book. Home health and hospice aid and medical school dropout, Alice Hammond has to wrestle with this question. Peter Cobb is the former executive director of the VNA of Vermont, and he draws on a subject he knows well for his debut novel. And he joins us now to discuss it. Peter, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me on your show.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Peter Cobb about To Alice, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Peter, tell us about your years as executive director at the Vermont Visiting Nurses Association.
Well, I was a director at the VNAs of Vermont for 33 years. When I started, it had a different name. It was the Vermont Association of Home Health Agencies. The association represents all the VNAs in the state. When I started, there were 22 agencies, and through mergers over the years, I think there's 9 now. The biggest change for my years was growth. When I started at the VNAs in 1983, for the most part, home health was a 9-to-5 job, with most of the visits during the day, Monday through Friday. But by the time I left, home health was a 24/7 organization with serving not just patients who needed custodial care, but patients who needed high-tech services and other services. So it grew huge. When I started in 83, I believe the VNAs were making about 300,000 visits a year. By the time I left, I was up to 1 million.
Wow. Ooh, that is quite a trajectory. Did you do much writing while you were as executive director at the VNA, or did you wait until you got a chance when you were retired?
Well, I actually wrote 2 novels prior to To Alice, and both were pretty terrible. What I can tell anybody listening is writing fiction is a learning process.
Yeah.
My first novel I wrote took me 20 years to write in. It was just awful. By the time I finished, I couldn't tell the ending from the beginning. And then I spent 2 years writing another novel again. It was much better, but still not very good, not worth submitting to anyone. But then when I retired 6 years ago, I sat down a couple years after that and decided I was going to write a novel and that I wanted to tell the home care story. And I think trial and error was needed by me anyway. And I think the product was finally, I knew what I was doing.
Peter, I love the idea of that first novel being, you know, an Escher painting, you know, novel, right? There's no beginning, there's no end. And you could say, no, that's how I meant to do it. It's just like Escher, you know.
Well, the first novel was the novel that you have, The Two Alice. Mm-hmm. I think that's 75,000 words. The other novel was 180,000, 190,000 words, like two times more, more than two times more. And it was unfocused and I couldn't tell you even what it's about when it was done. But I did learn how to write and how to write fiction.
Oh, that's great to hear. Where did the idea come from for Two Alice?
Well, the idea came obviously, from two places. First, it came from my work. Many of the stories that are told in the book are stories that I heard from the home care staff.
Mm-hmm.
I used to attend the clinical directors meetings three or four times a year and the social workers meetings and the physical therapies meetings, and I would listen to their stories. So many of those stories are in the book. It also, based on people I know, most of the characters are composites of people I know,
mm-hmm.
and the town, Providence, this fictional town of Providence, Vermont, is greatly inspired by Rutland, where I grew up, and Barrie, where I live now.
Mm, interesting. All right. Well, tell us about the protagonist in the book, Alice Hammond.
Well, Alice Hammond, she's very troubled. She drops out of medical school for various reasons. I'll let the readers find them out.
Mm-hmm.
And she has decided to live her life through her patients. She has no friends, no social life, nothing but her work. And that's not a good thing for her. It's not a good thing for her patients. And it certainly isn't a good thing for the agency. She's a wonderful home health aide. Her patients love her. She gets the best reviews by her patients. But she has made them her friends, and that's not what should happen. And it's a common issue, not just for home health, but for all social services. It's hard not to get involved. Think about a hospice worker, for example. Hospice workers will be with a family during the worst times and the best times, and as someone is dying, and it's hard not to get totally involved and totally attached. And I'll give you an example from my mother. My mother was on, I don't know if you know what the Choices for Care program is, but it's a program of long-term care services for Vermonters on Medicaid. And my mother was on that for a couple of years, and a couple of years before that we did services. And she had one of her aides came in twice a week for, I think, 3 years. Obviously, an attachment grows there.
Sure.
So this novel tries to get at where is that line between giving great care and crossing over when you're too involved.
Yeah, the term boundaries comes into play an awful lot throughout To Alice. And set us up with the premise for the story then.
Well, Alice has, I think there are five or six patients, and she goes through them. I should tell you that the novel is about Alice, but it's equally about her patients.
Right.
There's a woman who's turning 100, and she and her son argue over whether she should or she shouldn't be in a nursing home. And you also learn from her what it's like to grow up Italian in Vermont in the 1920s. And then there's a young woman, 37, who is dying. She's on hospice, and her husband and her 13-year-old daughter are having a very difficult time dealing with her death. And there's a man who, as a young man, he and his wife were ballroom dance champions. And he hasn't danced since his wife's death, which was 12 years before. But in this novel, he dances again at 89 years old. And there's a story about a young man who suffers an accident and diving in shallow water. And he uses a wheelchair, and Alice helps him. And throughout the book, you see that he finds love. And there's a story about a kind of a crotchety old guy who's a decent guy but crotchety, and his wife left him 30 years before, I think. I can't remember, actually. But anyway, his life has spiraled downhill since his wife left him. And you get the you get their lives, and you get how they and Alice interact.
Yeah, that would be a lumberjack. There's a, you know, that kind of really comes into play, his story, when he passes, and Alice.
Yeah, there's a lumberjack. He suffers a terrible accident, and she cares for him for 3 years. He can't get himself in the tub, and there's a lot of things he needs for daily living. Mm-hmm. And when he dies, he leaves her his property and his money.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother, who's also cared for him over those same 5 year period, is pretty furious that his brother has left a substantial amount of property. It's 200 acres and a substantial amount of money, $125,000. And he had left it to a home health aide, and the brother thinks he should have gotten the money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the property valued around $2 million. And like Peter said, about $125,000 in liquid cash. So this is really then becomes the crux of the novel to Alice. In your time at the VNA, did you ever run into a situation similar to this where a patient left most, if not all, of their property, their possessions to a home healthcare worker?
No, not that I know of. It may have happened, but not that I know of. I do know where the patient left small things to staff, but not to the degree that's in the book.
Good, because as I was reading it, I kept thinking, I wonder how Peter Cobb would have handled this, this situation. Because we do hear in the book, we hear how the administration handles it, you know, at the VNA, you know, for Alice. And it's a tough situation. We also get, you know, to see how lawyers angle in this type of situation throughout the book. Peter, as I read the book, I must admit, you don't make these VNA jobs sound very enticing. You tell it kind of warts and all. Are you afraid this might scare people away from the profession?
Oh, I hope not. I certainly didn't intentionally do that. What I tried to do is to tell the VNA story, or the home health and hospice story. If you think about all the fiction that you've with a healthcare setting, it's almost always hospitals, and it's almost always about physicians doing heroic things. How many times have you seen doctors put paddles on the patient and they raise them from the dead? But what I thought I was doing, hoped I was doing, was celebrating this kind of care that home health agencies provide. What many people need is not a hero. What they need is someone to help them with their daily chores of daily living, cutting their toenails when they can't cut them,
right,
taking a bed bath when they need help to get into the tub. When they need help to get in the tub, help, or a bed bath if they need that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I did that. I mean, it is not an easy job for sure, but it's a rewarding job, and the relationship between Alice and her patients, I think, is a strong bond that she had with them, and I think home health agencies get that because they get to be in people's homes. More than anyone else, they see where the people live. They see their family. They see their friends. They see their home. So they have a special view of the world of their patients that I'm not sure if any other healthcare providers get that.
What type of person thrives in this type of job, Peter?
Well, I think you have to be independent for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're a nurse and you go into someone's house and you have a question, you can't walk down the hall of your hospital or walk down the hall of the nursing home and say, gee, I have a question. You have to be independent enough to trust your own judgment, to know that you're doing the right thing, and know when you need help, when you need to call your supervisor. But it takes an independent person. It takes a person who's willing to go into people's homes, because there is a lot of travel involved. You're going the back roads of Vermont.
Get stuck in them sometimes, as Alice did.
Oh, they definitely get stuck. There's no question about that. That's something you hear all the time. And cars break down.
Yeah.
You're on there and you have to break down. And some agencies, not so much in Vermont, but in some of the bigger, you know, bigger states and bigger agencies, they actually provide cars for some of their staff. But I think it's mostly someone who really enjoys being in people's homes and being with them in their lives.
Now, Alice, who really does care for her patients, gets to know them, is often reprimanded for this. And, you know, is that right? Are you trying to send a message that there does need to be some compassion and connection between that home healthcare professional and their patients?
Well, no, what I'm trying to show is that the boundary between good, giving great care and going a little bit too far is very fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult sometimes to know when you've crossed the line because you become so involved with your patients. She gets reprimanded for sure because I think boundary issues are very important to agencies of all sorts, to schools, to nursing homes, to hospitals, to home health. There, you know, it's a serious issue where you, when a staff person crosses the line, it puts her in jeopardy, it puts the patient in jeopardy, and also puts the agency in jeopardy. So there is a line that you have to stay on the correct side of, and it's hard.
Yeah.
And it's especially hard in home health.
I'll mention a few things that to me seem quite benign, and yet she was reprimanded for. In the case of the person who dies, this lumberjack, she would play chess with him a little bit after her call. She brought him, I think, three small gifts over 3 years. It's like birthday presents or some other, you know. So those are the types of things that, you know, are fuzzy. That's a great
word. They're very fuzzy. In fact, yeah. It works the other way, too. I know my mother used to try to give her caregivers food and gifts. So it works both ways. And staff really shouldn't give gifts to their patients, and they shouldn't receive gifts because you can take advantage of your patient if you're not careful, or the patient can take advantage of you. Mm-hmm. So yeah, those things seem benign, but once the person's work is done, the staffer really shouldn't stay late and play chess like Alice does. Alice is a wonderful person, but I think when you read the book, you realize maybe she shouldn't have done that.
Mm-hmm. Alice's family becomes an important character in the book. Tell us about their relationship with Alice.
Well, Alice's dad is a physician in the Providence Hospital, and he pretty much figured it was preordained for Alice to become a physician, just like him, become a surgeon, and join him in the surgery center at the hospital. And in fact, from when she was a little child until she's in med school, she thought so too. She also thought her life was preordained, that she too would become a surgeon. So very much in the beginning of the book, when you learn about her early days, she's very much a driven young woman, an A personality who always succeeds and always wins. But through the events that happened in the college, she rethinks her life. She's tired of being an A personality. She's tired of the whole grind. And she realizes that she really didn't want to be a physician. She wanted to be a physician to please her dad, not something she wanted to do. So her father, he's very influential on her. And her mother happens to be a VNA nurse when Alice was young. And Alice realizes that that's a pretty good thing. That makes sense to me. And her brother is a surgeon, and he is actually the one who's going to follow the dad. And then she has a sister who's a lawyer. So to her father, the son who's the doctor and the daughter who's the lawyer, they seem to be pretty successful. Now, here's Alice at a low-paid home health aide job,
right.
And he sees that as not very successful. But Alice sees it as a great success because she believes she really believes in what she's doing.
How does it feel to have the fruits of your labor manifested in an actual published book, Peter?
Well, it's, you know, it's funny because I told myself when I sent it out that I would accept 25 rejections, and then my ego would be crushed and I wouldn't do it. But I sent it out three places and I only got one rejection, which was shocked me. I got to tell you, it really shocked me. It's both invigorating and also humbling. But I'm obviously pleased. In fact, I've got a second novel that will be out later, either later this year or next year.
You want to tease us a little about what you're writing about for second
novel?
It's
totally different. It takes place in 1929 Vermont and 1962 Vermont. And the main character, John Gauthier, in 1929, he's a farmhand in a very small hardscrabble farm in Providence, East Providence, Vermont, and he falls in love with the farmer's wife and also with her sister. So he falls in love pretty easily. and obviously that's not a very good thing to do, to fall in love with your boss's wife. And later on in the 1930s, he becomes a priest. And we learn about his life as a priest in the 1960s, when he befriends a young boy and teaches the boy about good literature and how to write.
Very interesting. All right. And very quickly, we had about 30 seconds left. You use a lot of names of people close to you, but really not their stories. Were you afraid that maybe people reading the book would think that this is nonfiction about your friends and family whose names you used?
Well, yeah. I use my daughter and her whole family. My granddaughter is Alice Hammond.
Yeah.
And her whole family names. And if I seriously thought I was going to get published, I wouldn't use those names. I actually expected total rejections, if you want to know the truth. And then after they said yes, I had to call up my daughter and warn her. I said, my daughter's Leslie. And I said, Leslie, I hate to tell you, but I've used you and your family's name in a novel I've written. So I sent them the novel, and they read it. And they said, okay, that's fine. They just wanted to make sure they didn't look bad.
No, it is not them.
It is not them. But, I would not have used those names if I thought I was going to get published.
Peter Cobb's new novel is called To Alice. It's published by Touchpoint Press. It's available at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier. Peter, I want to thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Okay, thank you very much.
Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll catch up with what's been happening in the world from national correspondent Bob Ney. And coming up today at 1, we've got three big, massive attack hours of The Getaway with none other than grinning Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. And now it's time to check in with national correspondent Bob Ney. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, hello. How are you?
I'm great. How you been?
I'm hanging in there, put it that way.
That's good.
I'm doing okay.
Now, you and I really anticipated, we had great anticipation to see how things would go for President Biden with his trip to Saudi Arabia. So give us a recap on what you saw.
Well, as you know, I had said when the trip was announced it was a mistake. I compared it to the staff giving him a political lit stick of dynamite and duct taping it to his hand.
Right.
And that's how I felt. The trip turned out different. It turned out worse than I thought. So I think that it was a mistake. He went to the kingdom, and then he did the fist bump. And people might say, okay, Bob, you're really going to get trite. But let me explain on this one.
Sure.
He did the fist bump versus the handshake, and he was criticized by members of Congress. And then he made a statement about supposedly that he said to Mohammed bin Salman that we felt he was responsible for the murder. Then supposedly Mohammed bin Salman said, well, he didn't say that, and he said it through his Secretary of State, we would call it, his foreign minister. And so then you had a he said, she said, and the president was criticized, you know, for that. Now, you'll say, well, Bob, you know, naturally Republicans do this. All the criticism came from Democrats. Bernie Sanders, Ilhan Omar, and others, including Adam Schiff. And then the publisher of the Washington Post did a piece on how he shouldn't have hand-bumped. It was too intimate. So overall, that was not a good scene for the president. Then he leaves, and yesterday what happens, but Mohammed bin Salman, after this whole visit, and we're going to be friendly with you, et cetera, he gets on the phone, Mohammed bin Salman, yesterday, the ruler of Saudi Arabia, and he talks to Putin, and they become really nice friends over the phone. So I think overall it's a trip to forget.
Yeah. And Putin, you know, you say what you want about him, is really displaying some savvy diplomacy, as you said, on the phone with bin Salman, but also Tehran summit. Tell us about that.
Well, he had the Tehran summit, which, you know, he went to talk to the supreme leader who runs Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, and then he talked to Raisi, the president of Iran, and he was well received. They have, you know, some, you know, mutual interests, et cetera, and they talked about Syria, so, you know, they made nice with each other, and of course, Saudi Arabia. This is what's really fascinating, Rick. Saudi Arabia, of course, hates Iran, just can't stand Iran. Here's Putin going to Tehran, you know, doing this whole conference, and then Mohammed bin Salman gets on the phone with him, and it's, you know, it's a love affair. And it's just amazing because Putin seems to be having his way, frankly, wherever he goes.
Yeah. And then his guy Lavrov heading to Cairo. What's going on there?
Well, that's a great question you're asking because, again, President Biden was over there. We're making all these efforts in the Mideast. We want Israel and the Palestinians to talk. We're, you know, getting cozy with the Arab League, et cetera. And now the Arab League, 22 Arab states, have invited the foreign minister of Russia. He's on his way right now to address the 22-nation Arab League. So any of the, you know, good feelings and we're going to work with the Arabs that was out there, well, Russia's, I'm not saying is going to undo us, but Russia is out there and, you know, they're obviously not out in the cold because their foreign minister is going to be addressing the entire 22 Arab League nation.
Yeah, it's a chess match, and right now it looks like the Russians, who have always been good at chess, are doing quite well.
True.
Let's talk about, you know, we've kind of steered away from COVID for a while. Let's talk about monkeypox. I know it sounds funny, but how serious is this?
You know, we don't know yet, and I've been, you know, trying to keep an eye on this, and you have a little bit of a debate here and there that was mildly out there. But then yesterday, the World Health Organization, the WHO, reconvened an emergency committee to reconsider whether it should declare monkeypox a public health emergency because they weren't declaring it a public health emergency. And so something is going on that I guess, you know, they're seeing that all of a sudden says, hey, maybe we ought to. So they've reconvened the meeting. Let's see what they say. Look at the numbers now. Right now, global cases around the world have surpassed 14,000. Now, I'm going to be real, real cautious here, Rick, yeah, because I don't want to say, well, it's only 14,000 cases. This takes me back in a haunting way to COVID. Mm-hmm. Well, we only have, well, you know, 100 cases, and we all know where that ended up.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see what they say, what they think, what the number assessment's going to be, and we'll see. Right now, the vast majority of cases continue to be reported of men who have sex with men, but that doesn't mean it couldn't go into the heterosexual community, because we know how AIDS at first was considered a, quote, gay disease, and right, then it went into the heterosexual community.
Yeah, and Bob, I'm with you. I think back to January 2020 when I heard about the coronavirus,
right,
and thought, that's, yeah, just, yeah. And then, mm-hmm, yeah, it didn't take
long. Here we go.
That's right. Let's talk about this January 6th committee. What did we learn last night, Bob?
I really have to give the committee credit. When they went about almost, I guess, a year and 4 months, I said, okay, couldn't you find something by that amount of time? That's a long time, you know, to go. And people said, well, Watergate went longer and Benghazi went longer. Well, that was a problem with Benghazi, too. It went too many times, too many places. But I must say, in the last hearings that they have now put together, which have been done quite well, they've been, you know, orchestrated and scripted out. Well, last night was quite fascinating because it focused on Trump going back to the White House. What did he do? But here's the thing that really we have to look at, I think. Is it criminal? I'm not going to say that it rises to the level of a criminal action. However, last night I watched every minute of it, and it's disturbing. To say it's not disturbing is not being, it's not being candid. It is disturbing. We're watching person after person, Pottinger, who was the deputy with the National Security Agency. Matthew, she was in the press office. We're watching all these people, the president's White House counsel. You know, you've got Pence's people. You had Miller, who's a Trump loyalist. All of these people made it crystal clear they are Trump loyalists, that he did good things, quote. Then you've got the but, you know, they were so personally taken back. And then it showed person after person after person, including his daughter, who tried to get him to make statements. And meanwhile, he's on the phone while they piece together.
And when you say statements, Bob, statements to the protesters to back off, right?
Sorry, yeah.
That's okay.
Statements to the protesters, stern, solid statements to the protesters, and it just went on and on. And then it showed that they don't know who completely, but the president was making calls to Republican senators, even after the Capitol was being ripped apart, saying, hey, you know, you need to stop this whole, you know, electoral college process. And then Rudy Giuliani calls, and in the midst of people thinking they're going to be killed, and is trying to talk to high Republican officials about, hey, you know, we got to do something about this electoral college. They're trying to get out and, you know, save themselves from potentially being hurt or killed. And it was effectively put together. It was an ugly deal, and it did not put former President Trump in a good light. Again, is it indictable? I don't believe so, but it was not a good night for the White House, because these were all Republicans and all Trump Republicans that were obviously giving statements that was not very good for the White House,
more
for the president.
I think there's more to come around September. Bob, the person I don't think we've heard from, I don't know that I could hold my tongue. I don't know how I'd feel, but I wonder what you know about how Mike Pence feels as more and more is revealed.
Well, I think Pence is obviously becoming more aggressive. He is going to be at what I'll call a dueling event tonight. Trump's going to be, you know, at another event, and they're both going to be speaking. But I think Pence has began to, you know, say some things that, and I saw what he said at the conference last week in D.C. He's beginning to say some things that, you know, look, you have to stand up for the Constitution, et cetera, and in a sense, sort of distance himself from Trump. Now, having said that, the fact remains, though, I don't believe Mike Pence can get the nomination.
Yeah.
I just don't believe he can, because there are enough people that think he should have done more, and Pence knew he couldn't do more, and he kind of did the little dance, Rick, of, well, he took a month to talk to Dan Quayle and others. Really, that day he should have looked the president in the eye and said, you know, I can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, because I knew he couldn't do it. I've been on the Electoral College. He knew he couldn't do it. But he kind of took that month to go back to Trump and say, hey, I talked to Dan Quayle. I talked to these lawyers. I can't do it. So he danced a little bit on that. But I think he is trying to separate himself without, you know, coming out and swinging at the former president.
Yeah, most definitely. Bob Ney, thanks so much for your insightful perspective on world
Thank
events.
You.
All right, take care.
Thanks.
We're going to take a break and then return to talk with Kathy Resmer of 7 Days about when Vermont went global with Globes. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. We hear a lot about the great scales that were produced in St. Johnsbury, that John Deere was born in Middlebury, the precision tooling of Springfield, and the printing feats that took place in Brattleboro. But sometimes forgotten in all that Vermont industrial history is the story of good old James Wilson of Bradford. But Kathy Resmer of 7 Days is keeping his story alive, and she's here to share it. Kathy, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks so much, Rick. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you. Give us a little background on this James Wilson cat.
Sure. So James Wilson was a farmer. He was born in New Hampshire. And right around 1796, he moved with his family to Bradford, Vermont. Right around that same time, he went to Dartmouth College on a visit and saw his first globe, the first map of the world, spherical map of the world. And he became obsessed with it and decided that he was going to make one himself. That globe that he saw, like every other globe or in America at that time, was produced in Europe. And he, James Wilson, decided, I think I could make one of these here in Vermont. And he set out to do that. It took him about 15 years. He talked with cartographers and engravers and folks who had special skills that he did not. You know, he was a farmer. He apparently trained as a blacksmith, but he had very little formal schooling. So he didn't go to college or, you know, go to high school even. He didn't go to school. And he learned all this stuff on his own. And he managed to make, in 1810, he managed to make and sell these globes.
Based
on a variety of different sources.
Was he much of a globetrotter?
No. In fact, I was surprised to learn that he did venture out of Vermont. He did travel around New England, and he went to New York. He moved his company to the Albany area around 1817, but he didn't really go very far. He never crossed the Atlantic Ocean, never visited Europe, never visited any of the places that were on this map, really, outside of New England.
So what were these globes that he created in 1810 made of?
They were made of paper mache and wood and brass. I don't have my list in front of me. I should say that I everything I know about James Wilson, I have learned through the Vermont Historical Society.
Yep.
And Amanda Gustin, who is the woman there who has spent the last 18 months really reexamining James Wilson's life and story and going back to primary, you know, the sources that they have. He didn't leave a lot of written records of his process, but they had to study his correspondence. They studied the physical objects he left behind and really tried to figure out, you know, how did he make these globes? How did he learn enough about these different subject matter, you know, the different things he had to learn? How did he do that?
Yeah.
On his own, essentially? And, you know, one of the neat things is he bought, between the time that he saw his first globe and made his globe, he bought a set of Encyclopedia Britannica. And he read it, and he read, there's an article there on globe making, and he read that, and that was one of the ways that he learned and taught himself to do this.
Boy, he's pushing hard to become my favorite all-time Vermonter and replace Snowflake Bentley in that regard. Any idea why this became his thing? You know, James Wilson, I'm going to make globes.
You know, there is not a whole lot of, I think that he probably wasn't this introspective guy who's journaling about his feelings and emotions and things. He seemed like he was a doer.
Yeah.
You know, he was not sitting still. He was tinkering. And even up to the very end of his life, he lived into his 90s, which is remarkable even then, back then. And he was constantly tinkering with things. And towards the end of his life, he made this thing called an orrery. He made four of them, actually. He gave them away to different places, three or four of them. And one of them, the only one that's still in existence, is part of this exhibit at the Vermont Historical Society that's open now that people can see. An orrery is a map of the solar system. It's like a physical map of it. And there's like a hand crank, and you turn it, and the Earth revolves around the sun. You cannot do that with this, you know, historical object that is behind a glass case that you
right.
can look at it. It's really incredible that he managed to do this and make this stuff from his barn, from his farm workshop, basically.
Yeah. That blew me away, reading about that in addition to the globe, because I think you even mentioned that he has the Earth just like tilted on the axis just the right way.
Yeah.
So that it's like accurate. It's phenomenal what he did. This, getting back to the globes, how much detail was contained on the globes he created?
I don't understand quite that question. I mean, when you say detail, I mean, it was a map of the world.
Yep.
As it was known at the time.
Gotcha.
And he, you know, based it on of several different sources, so you can see the entirety of, you know, all the different continents, although, you know, some of the drawings are a little bit funny. There's one he did several series of these globes, and the one that he put out in 1810, I think the map of Japan makes it look kind of weird. And there are some things missing, like the Rocky Mountains aren't there, and in the later version of the globe, in 1811 version, Australia is just missing the bottom half. It's just not there. It just kind of ends, and at the time it was called New Holland. And you know, there's Amanda from the Vermont Historical Society sent me a photo. I didn't get a chance to use it in the 7-day story that we ran, but a picture of that, like the Australia that's just cut in half, and it just doesn't. There's no, the lines just sort of end, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, sorry, folks down there in Melbourne, you know, we didn't know about you then. So was he cranking these things out in mass production? I think first in Bradford and then over in Albany. How many was he making?
Well, you know, they don't know exactly how many he was making. The first set, there are only four that exist now. They think he made more than that. But he sold some to the neighbors. There are four that exist still. And there are more of the later versions. And, you know, part of the work that the Vermont Historical Society is undertaking right now is cataloging all of the globes that remain and trying to get an understanding of how many he actually created and how many there are still out there in the world. And they've expanded the list apparently quite a bit. They've found more Wilson globes than people knew about. But he, you know, he started production. He kind of like prototypes this thing in his workshop in Bradford. I think I mentioned this in the article, but the Vermont Historical Society folks brought the globe that they have, the 1810 and the 1831 globe. They brought them to Central Vermont Medical Center and x-rayed them.
You did.
And inside a globe apparently has to have a counterweight to make it spin effectively. And that 1810 globe, they found that Wilson had used for the counterweight just a bent nail that he put in there. You know, and I think he refined his technique later. He never moved to New York, but he put in his sons in charge of the company, and so it became Jade Wilson and Sons. And around 1817, they moved the production to Albany so they could really mass produce these things. And there are some records that survive saying, you know, there's a letter that Amanda was telling you about where one of the sons says, well, we were something about producing 300 spheres, whether that was like a year or a batch or at the time, it's not entirely clear, but hundreds of globes. And they were sold all across the country.
And how much would a Wilson globe have set me back in the early 1800s?
Well, let me go back and just double check before I say that. So they, you know, he's got these terrestrial globes that show that, you know, will be the thing that you're familiar with that shows the map of the world. But then they also have these celestial globes, which show the stars and the constellations. And so they would sell these as a pair. So you would buy a celestial and a terrestrial globe. So back then, if you wanted to get a globe from London, import a globe from London, at the time it would cost $200, which would be roughly $3,300 today. Uh-huh. And if you wanted to get a pair of Wilson's terrestrial and celestial globes, you could get them for $50 to $75, which is, you know, $750 to $1,250 today.
Yeah.
So it was considerably cheaper to buy one of these American-made globes that James Wilson was churning out.
But still a chunk of change. Very quickly, we've got 30 seconds. What is the Historical Society doing in connection with Wilson's creations?
There is an exhibit, it's a fantastic exhibit you can see at the Vermont History Museum called James Wilson, A New American Globe, and it's the official title of it, and you should go check it out. The Historical Society is doing this museum exhibit. They're also doing a scholarly article, and a six-part podcast is in the works.
How cool.
So look for that sometime soon.
Oh, I love it. You can read Kathy Resmer's story on James Wilson and his Globes in this week's issue of 7 Days or at 7daysvt.com. Kathy, thanks for sharing that story with us.
Thanks so much, Rick. It's great to talk to you.
All right. We're going to take a break for the news, and then we'll return to hear how you can catch a game and net a job. And tonight, the Sox are finally back in action. They host the Toronto Blue Jays with our coverage beginning at 6:10. Joe Castiglione has the first pitch at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Like baseball? Looking for a job? No, I'm not promising you'll get George Costanza's gig as the New York Yankees assistant to the traveling secretary, but I do have a way for you to see a ball game and be considered for a number of jobs. It's the Vermont Department of Labor's Triple Play Job Fest, happening at several different venues in Vermont. Here with all the details is Vermont Labor Commissioner Michael Harrington. Commissioner Harrington, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. Listeners, to ask Commissioner Harrington a question or to share a comment, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Let's take a look at the employment and job picture in Vermont. What is the employment rate now, Commissioner?
The unemployment rate.
Yes.
The unemployment rate is at record lows, which I don't think is surprising. I mean, that seems to be the case, especially in the Northeast here. Everybody knows that there are way more jobs out there than there are people looking for work, which is obviously a challenge for us. But the good news on that front is that it is a job seeker's market. Yeah. So there's a lot of opportunity out there for people who are looking for work. Maybe they want to change a job. Maybe they want to upskill themselves into something new or different. So there's for the listeners, there's a lot of opportunity for them to either find work or change jobs. I think the struggle we know right now is on the employer side, and we're all feeling it because, you can't go anywhere in the state right now without seeing help wanted signs or adjusted hours on a business because they don't have coverage for a shift. Or maybe you're waiting in line a little bit longer because there's only so many registers open. So again, we definitely know that there's a struggle across the state, and it is our top priority to expand Vermont's workforce. You know, we're not going to be able to solve this issue with just the people we have in our state. It's going to take a lot more than that because there are just so many jobs available right now, which is good news. It also is not just a Vermont problem. You know, yeah. We are seeing this same struggle across the entire country.
And I know you never have an exact number of how many jobs are open, but do you have a general range of what you think the state currently has with job openings?
Yeah, sorry. I don't always have, like you said, there's not always an exact number.
Right.
But we do have data that shows it's right now about 3 to 1. So there are 3 job openings for every 1 person looking. At one point, it was, I think, somewhere around 20 to 25,000 job openings across the state at any given time. It's definitely a job seeker's market out there. with a lot of different opportunity, but it is, you know, it is creating a very challenging environment for employers.
Boy, I keep saying it would be great to just be graduating from high school or college, because you could really have your pick of what you'd like to do. That 3-to-1 number is really pretty incredible. What is the role that the Department of Labor plays in trying to match, you know, the job seekers with the employers?
Yeah, well, and to your point, right, I mean, how quickly times change. It was just 2 or 3 years ago where we were saying, I would hate to be somebody graduating from college right now with the entire economy in upheaval because of the pandemic. And now we're saying, you know, I would have loved to have been a college student graduating this year, or coming out of a certificate or degree program of some kind, because there's just so much opportunity. With the department, I think most people know we do a lot of different things. We have a lot of different divisions within the department, but one of our largest divisions is our workforce development division. And there are two components to that. One is on the employer side, where we're helping employers get their jobs posted on the state job board. We help them coordinate and promote hiring events. We may pull them together in a job fair of some kind, or help them with technical assistance in either writing job postings or conducting meaningful interviews, or even just promotion of available jobs. But the other component there is working with job seekers themselves. And so, you know, typically it's individuals who are maybe new to the workforce, or haven't had to write a resume in a long time, or, you know, participate in an interview. So some of it is, you know, just immediate needs of helping them get prepared to, you know, look for work and be successful in that work. And then it could also be more technical in nature, in terms of linking them up with a training program or some type of certificate program, because they want to, you know, maybe gain a skill as a CDL driver, or enroll in an apprenticeship program to become an electrician, or some, you know, something along those lines. I mean, we have so many different registered apprenticeship programs in our state that cover everything, like I said, from electrical and plumbing to the Vermont State Police, to construction and some other areas, so or healthcare. You know, so we have, I think, over 30 different types of programs, but more than 300 different program sites where people can participate in an apprenticeship program in some way, shape, or form.
Michael, I'm so glad you brought up what can seem like insurmountable hurdles to someone who's either looking for a job or looking to change careers. I just helped a friend who had never written a resume before in his life. I think he's in his late 50s, and I'm sure he was thinking, how am I ever going to get this done? He now has two different versions to look at, to consider as he goes forward. So these are things that the Department of Labor can help you with. I know you were involved with the big job fair at the Champlain Expo. There was also one at the Barry Odd. How many employers were at each, and how successful were they at attracting new employees during those job fairs?
Yeah, so what I can say is probably relatively anecdotal, but as you can imagine, this year we had many employers wanting to participate. I think we had the spring usually kicks off our hiring season. So we had job fairs, or, you know, co-sponsored job fairs across the state in the months of April, May, and June. One of those was the one you mentioned in partnership with AGC at the Champlain Valley Expo. And there were hundreds of employers at that event. And the problem is what we're seeing right now is there's just the population of individuals looking for work is very small. And I should say it's small in comparison to other years, or, you know, prior to the pandemic. So that gap between the number of jobs and the number of people actually looking for work has gotten wider and wider. And so, but my understanding from the different employers that I talked to at these events is that, one, they were just happy to be there in person and be able to have face-to-face conversations and shake people's hands and actually engage on, you know, other than like some type of virtual meeting. So they like being out after 2 years of the pandemic. But I also heard that what they were seeing in terms of interest from people were quality applications. Many of them either immediately scheduled second interviews for folks, or had or did an offer right on site at the event. So again, the demand is high, and I think if you're you know, if you bring talent to the table, somebody's going to scoop you up really quick.
Yeah, and job seekers, I hope you're hearing this message. If you're looking, now is the time to definitely strike. Michael, what is the Triple Play Job Fest?
So to the point about the job fairs is that we know it's becoming harder and harder because the population of people is smaller to get people to come to a job fair. And so our communications team here at the department, along with our workforce development team, began thinking, okay, what are some creative ways we can get employers and their jobs in front of people without trying to corral people to come to a job fair? And so I think one of the really unique and creative ways was to create the Triple Play Job Fest series, which we partnered with three different baseball teams across the state. And during game night, we've got one tonight, we've got two next week, and employers are going to come out. They're going to set up their tables and their booths and share what they have to offer. And we're encouraging people who want to attend those events to come early and speak with employers. They can, if they fill out their Triple Play scorecard, they can get free admission into the game along with some other value there as well.
All right. And the first one, and these are all three across our listening area. First one is in White River Junction with the Upper Valley Nighthawks. Next week, you've got the Mountaineers in Montpelier and, of course, the Lake Monsters in Burlington. Now, Michael, does a job applicant need to buy a ticket for the game? How does this work out?
So the best way they can do that, and so folks who are listening, the Upper Valley Nighthawks is tonight, July 22nd. The time of the hiring event is at 5 o'clock. The first pitch goes out at 6 p.m. And then, like you said, next week, Wednesday, July 27th, we're with the Mountaineers. The event is actually earlier in the day. It's 11 to 2. And then the game is at first pitch goes out at 6:30. And then Burlington Lake Monsters is the 28th of July, Thursday, with the event at 5:30 and first pitch at 6:35. So, again, the best thing people can do to go on early, register in advance, you go to labor.vermont.gov. Or you can call 802-828-4394, 802-828-4394, and you can also visit your local job center for additional information. Walk-up registration will be accepted as well, but if we can get that information in advance, it's easier to send follow-up information and instructions to people who have registered in advance.
All right. It is such a novel approach. Have you heard of other states doing this, or is this something that you all cooked up there at the Department of Labor?
It was actually something that our team here came up with on their own. I can't say whether someone else has done it somewhere else, but I think what we do know is that as states, the old way of doing things is no longer working, or at least not not with this how tight the labor market is right now. So, you know, even in our workforce development division, where we used to have one of our regional offices, we'd unlock the door at you know, 8 a.m. and people could just walk in all day long and walk out. You know, foot traffic has slowed since the pandemic. And so we're having to also find new and creative ways to get out into the community and meet people where they are instead of expecting people to come to us. I think that same concept applies here, where we could have an event where everybody would show up simply for the sake of going to a job fair. And that's no longer the case. Just because, again, there just aren't that many people searching. But if, you know, we know that there's going to be 2,000, 3,000, or 4,000 people going to a baseball game on a particular night, we can throw the employers right in front of their faces and hopefully catch some people that we wouldn't normally go to a job fair.
All right. Let me run through again the dates and how you can pre-register or learn more. Tonight, it's down in White River Junction, the Upper Valley Nighthawks. Wednesday night of next week, we've got the Mountaineers, and then Thursday, the Lake Monsters in Burlington for the Triple Play Job Fest. And you can go to labor.vermont.gov or call 802-828-4394. And, Michael, even though it's a seller's market right now, still vitally important to put your best foot forward in a situation like this. So, what do people need to, first of all, bring with them? Is a physical resume still a thing? Is it all digital? Does it help to have both at the ready?
Definitely, I would bring a resume if you have it. It's not required. And what we are finding is that even just walking around, talking with the employers are willing to work with whoever shows up. And if they have an interested candidate, certainly great to be able to leave a resume there with them. Some employers will have you fill out an employment application on the spot. But I think even giving them your name and contact information, but I don't think you should also wait for them to call you back, right? Mm-hmm. So if you go to the event and you get the information from an employer you're interested in working for, you know, the first thing you should do the next business day is give them a call and follow up yourself. Certainly, it's important to look, look the part. And I don't want to say look professional. Not every job requires a suit and tie or even a shirt and tie. But certainly making sure you're putting your best foot forward, that they see you and they think that, yep, this is someone who fits in with our culture. They're dependable. They're, engaging. They're smart. It's somebody I would want on my team. They're going to bring value to my company. That's the type of foot I think people want to put forward.
You use the word engaging. This is really important. I think employers love it when you have some interest. So what types of questions should the job seeker kind of have prepared when they're approaching a potential employer?
Yeah, so you bring up a great question about having questions, right? So yeah. If you want to be engaging, it's not always about what you have to say. It's about listening too. And so being able to ask questions of the employer so you have a really good understanding of what they're looking for in a good candidate. But also you're trying to make a decision as to whether this employer is a good fit for you. So, you're going to want to know what are they looking for in a candidate? What types of skills do you need to have? What shifts are they hiring for? Or what type of job are they hiring for? What's the team environment like? What's the culture there of the company? You may want to ask about benefits or time off if those are two key areas of importance for you. But I think it's really more about just saying, does this company represent what I'm about? Are they not only offering me a job that pays well, but would I also be proud to work for the company and wear their logo, if you will, out there? So again, it really depends on what the individual is looking for, but definitely thinking about, what are the questions that I want to ask to know more about the company, but what are the questions the company is likely to ask me? And maybe I want to think through what my answers would be if they said, hey, what value would you bring to our company as a new employee? Mm-hmm. You may want to think about, okay, what would be the value I would bring to that company? So you're not trying to just think of it on the spot.
job seekers who can't make any of the job fests. Vermont JobLink is an effective tool. What will people find there? How can they effectively use that resource, Michael?
Yeah, so Vermont JobLink is the state's job board. So when we work with employers, we're capturing their available jobs. We're putting them into VermontJobLink.com. If you're a job seeker and you go to VermontJobLink.com, you can look for jobs that are out there. You can also upload, you know, create a profile, upload a resume. You can also connect with one of our staff people. I should also say there, you know, we also offer a lot of other resources as well. So, you know, if you're a dislocated worker, if you fall into one of our three federal programs, dislocated worker, youth, or adult programs, you know, we can also help provide financing for things. So if you are needing help with transportation, we may be able to help finance transportation to some degree. Like, let's say your car needs an inspection before you can drive it on the road. That may actually be eligible to be covered under the Department of Labor if you're enrolled in one of our programs. Or if you say, hey, I need new work boots in order to work for this one company. Again, if you're eligible and enroll in one of our programs, equipment and apparel and attire are also some things that can be covered as well. So there's a lot of support that we can offer individuals who might be new to the workforce and not be, have all the gear and everything they would need for a particular job. But we can also help you identify what that right job might be. So you may be somebody who's working in food service right now, but want to get your CDL license and become a plow truck driver for the state of Vermont in the winters, right? So we can also help you link you up with training program where in many cases the costs are fully covered either by the employer or by our programs. And we could actually get you your CDL certificate and have a job waiting on the other end. So a lot of different supports depending on what the needs are. So I would just tell anybody who's looking for work and might need additional support in helping find work that they should just call us and we can help you out. And if we're not the right spot, we'll direct you to the right spot. But we've got a bunch of staff in the field in local communities, and we would link you up with someone locally to help give you some assistance.
Michael Harrington is the commissioner of the Department of Labor. To learn more about the Triple Play Job Fest and all that we were talking about this morning, you can go to labor.vermont.gov or call 802-828-4394. Commissioner Harrington, thanks for being on the show again.
Rick, thanks for having me. We'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivrigan. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday.